The views and opinions expressed on Geeks Under the Influence are that of the panelists and not of our sponsors, Amazon.com and TeePublic. Parental discretion is advised.
Queer things that were and shall be again. A changing of the guard, the dead's marching in. You think you can hold out, but you know you're wrong. So you better join us now. You better do it fast or you will be. Necronomicon gives us power to rise from the dead. You play the tape.
Geeks, welcome to a very special mini-sode all about Midnight Mass, the new series that dropped on Netflix that has all sorts of spooky goodness for the holiday season. And instead of a GY Nights this week, we decided that this show was so important to talk about that it was more important to do a little mini episode for this week instead of doing a GY Nights to really break it down. It wasn't on our calendar, but damn if it wasn't a good series that needed to be talked about.
Yeah, I got to say, this is the, for me personally, fourth time Flanagan's just blow me away with something that all of a sudden is like, oh no, this is very important now.
Yeah.
The man just continues to do it, you know?
Each property that I've watched of his has continually gotten stronger. And this one, with how personal it was to him, I think really was just like that ultimate hammer swing for him.
I still haven't seen Bly Manor. And I don't know why I kept putting it off. Like, it just was like always on my list. But now I feel like I need to fast track it to the beginning of my list because I am dying to watch it now.
I'm actually in the same boat as you. So,
oh, yeah, that's right. We talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
And he does have a slew of movies as well that you could add to the top of your list. He's got about six. Five.
Yeah, well, Hush is up there for me.
Hush, and we did check out the Ouija movie, The Origin of Evil, the one that he did.
He also did Oculus about the haunted mirror.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Doctor Sleep.
Doctor Sleep.
Mm-hmm. Gerald's
his
game.
Early film. He did Abstentia, Hush. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Before we get too deep into it, let's very quickly announce the panel for this minisode here. Burlesque star, regular panelist, contributor, just overall creative across the board, our friend, our family member, Murphy Lawless is here.
Hi, friends. Love you.
Yay.
You and Amy Bogard were on a beautiful Disasters that should be coming out here pretty shortly, I think, right?
We got to watch a really bonkers Bollywood movie. It was called Dund, The Fog, which was a Bollywood remake of I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Okay. Why the fuck would they want to remake that goddamn travesty of a film?
Because there was so little storyline to that they had plenty of room for the dance numbers.
Dance numbers.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Still made it more manageable than some of the other lengths of film.
True, but God, that movie's so bad.
But Amy kicked ass on it. Aww. And nice. I had a blast watching the movie with her.
It was so fun.
Oh my gosh.
Mm. Previously mentioned and next to me on the we're doing this as a quick Zoom. The purveyor of Deeply Upsetting and a regular contributor to the GUI network, we got Amy Bogard here.
Hi.
Ooh.
Hi. It's so fucking sweet.
Hi, it's me.
Hi.
Hello, friends.
We got to sit down and watch the show together.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested to talk about, you know, as both of us came from like religious backgrounds to a degree. Just how that affected our viewpoint on watching the show is going to be a big part of this conversation, I think, for sure.
Definitely.
And then just some of the hymns and stuff that they sang, it was like PTSD flashbacks as they started singing the hymns. We're like,
and of course,
God.
They had to make it like good versions of the hymn. Like, they were very beautifully done versions of the hymn. So you're like,
Yeah, my partner had very similar flashbacks as he also grew up Catholic. And I found out that the composer that they used on this are the Newton Brothers. He's used them, I think, for every film since Oculus.
Wow.
So, they've been like one of his most consistent collaborators. And so it was cool to hear what they came up with to match gospel hymns and Neil Diamond.
Yeah.
I'm going to say they did it.
Yeah.
They did the damn thing.
And speaking of consistent collaborators and also the, we've got my partner in crime on Geeks on the Influence and runs the network and my partner on GY and GY Nights. We've got From the Mouths of Madness host Lowdown Brown MacGyver.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Also, you forgot The Man Who's Pissed. They actually tried to remake I Know What You Did Last Summer. Because fuck that movie. Fuck that movie.
It's barely that. That's after a 40-minute romance plot. So there's not that much I Know What You Did Last Summer. Okay. It is very Bollywood.
There's no killer with a hook.
There's a rake.
There's like a fireplace rake.
It's like the Treehouse of Horror episode where they were making fun of Nightmare on Elm Street more than it was I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Well, with the romance plot, I think it's more of a I Know Who You Did Last Summer.
See, I could, okay. That's that.
It was like two hours and 35 minutes of film and then 5 minutes of aggressive exposition and a sudden ending. And we were like, what?
Oh, you gotta love rushed and really aggressive exposition. Love that.
I love it when a twist just completely fucks me up and runs me over with a train because it didn't make any sense. So there's no way to see it coming.
It just made no sense.
Could not have guessed that for a million years.
Nope.
Well, the man who is responsible for this train wreck that makes no fucking sense.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah. Amazing.
We got Mike Dabba-Bickett.
Yep, it's me.
Yay.
Welcome, everyone. Check out GUIpodcast.com. Yeah, that was a great lead-in. Several good lead-ins, honestly. Check out GUIpodcast.com for all the information on this show, all the other shows on the network, including From the Mouths of Madness and Deeply Upsetting and Smack My Pitch Up, which is my show. And plenty of others to choose from. So GUIpodcast.com. Join the conversation. Click our social media links and let us know what you want to hear on all this stuff. Rate, review, all that cool shit that you do for podcasts. And let's get into it because we've got limited time and a lot to talk about. Again, first off, spoilers, obviously, for anybody that has
heavy
spoilers. If you have not had the opportunity to watch Midnight Mass, the one thing that I will suggest is that it was a little bit slow for the first three episodes, for me at least, where it was a little bit of a slow burn. And after seeing the series, it was so important to have that slow burn. You had to introduce the characters, you had to get a good feel for this island and everybody's relationships with one another. It was so important. So when the rest happened, you were invested. That was so important.
Yeah. Yes. And yeah, exactly. But for me, so none of the episodes bothered me. But also I come from a hardcore King reader, and he can be the same way with his writing. Sure. Well as the show didn't start off initially slow. I mean, we actually started off with a big bang of him killing somebody driving drunk.
Sure.
Yep.
And that gave me enough to realize, okay, why are they setting up such a big deal that he's coming home? Like that to me, that they started the show with that is what, and then he's still dreaming about her when he goes to sleep. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's what's like, okay, what is this? You know?
Plus I felt like the scene setting up of this island was so important to really give that the space to breathe, because honestly, it's the claustrophobia of the island that's like a separate character almost. And so you had to kind of feel trapped there and kind of like an outsider, like the sheriff, in order to really like get into the spooky of it all.
Well, and that's something that really develops as the story goes along, is that nobody at the beginning of this movie really feels like the island is a cage. It's that there are a lot of people that for generations have been on this island, where they choose not to go to the mainland very often. They're happy in their setting, and there's some connection to the rest of the world, but it's so limited that people that have a better understanding of the world do feel claustrophobic. And that's kind of you're in as a viewer being like, yeah, I would fucking lose my mind in this little island.
For this island, one of the things that I found in an article that I shared with y'all is that Tangier Island, Virginia, is the primary inspiration for Crockett Island, which I have been to. It is two streets less than a mile long and one of the creepiest fucking places I've ever been.
Agreed.
Picturing myself stuck on something of that size, a mile, with religious fanatics, I immediately felt like I wanted to jump into the water and try to swim for it.
To me, the way it was portrayed, the exact reason why religion was so big there was because of the isolation. Like, we talk about claustrophobia, but it's, to me, it's more isolation, which, yeah, I know it's, I know they're hand in hand, but ultimately those words are different to me. Like, isolation means, to me, trapped. You know, like you can't escape, versus claustrophobia means you know, everything's just too crammed and you can't, there's not enough room for you to breathe. So,
well, I think we experience both through the different characters, yeah. which is why both Aaron and Riley leave the island, because they like, there's the speech that Aaron's mom gives her about every bird getting its wings clipped. And I think that they did experience that claustrophobia to that extent. And now as adults, they feel they're both searching for solitude and they're experiencing isolation, both as individuals who are kind of adrift in their lives, and people that are not quite trapped yet on this tiny island.
So I feel, I get what you're saying. As an adult, the isolation could come from the fact that they are not like everyone on the island. Everyone on the island seems fine and like going up, doing their job, making sure they make mass, doing their job, going to mass. That's not okay for them. So as adults, they feel isolated in their lives. And also as they're not the same as every other islander.
Let me clarify my statement that started this conversation. I, as the viewer, felt claustrophobic. That's how I felt. I felt like them kind of, and I didn't explain that well, really setting up the isolation of the island made me feel claustrophobic. And especially because the one choice for community is the Catholic Church. That is the only option for any sort of community on this isolated island. I immediately felt claustrophobic and like I wanted to get the fuck out.
And yep, I love that. You know, with most series and TV and movies, you have one character that you connect with in a way that is kind of like your through line as being an outside observer. When all the shit goes crazy, there's the one person that has their head together that you're kind of following with, being like, see, this is the one person that gets it. That is the sheriff to a degree in this series, where he's the one. And I absolutely love, and this is coming from somebody that is an atheist, that it wasn't an atheist sheriff, that it was just a sheriff of a different faith. I thought that was such an important note, that it wasn't condemning religion. It was condemning fanaticism. And by having him being a religious but open-minded person, and also shoving off all the stupid bullshit like stereotypes that Christians put on his faith, it was a really nice touch to have him escaping racism by jumping into an island of racism and being kind of the through line.
You get a decent amount of his character and relationship with his son, and why, and like, you think you know why he moved to the island, losing his wife and all that. And but then when his monologue happens, I am so glad it didn't happen earlier, because at the moment that that monologue happens, it hits home so fucking hard.
Oh, so good.
Like, that came at the exact right time. And you're like, okay, dude, I'm with you. Like, you got it. Because, yeah, I am a man of faith. I love God. I believe in God. God loves us all. But fuck this shit. This is not fucking God. He's like, this is not God.
That poor man trying to talk sense into this like extremist group of people, being like, we're all about Jesus too. Jesus was a great prophet.
And Bev.
Oh,
the crowd was with her in a large way though, which is why they kept overpowering Aaron.
They saw what he was saying. No,
there were some people that were starting to kind of understand where he was going. And that's where you even saw at the climax, which we'll get to a little bit more a little bit later, but that there were people that were kind of following along that went, oh, wait, nah, sorry. This is where I draw the line. This Jonestown bullshit is where I draw the line.
Oh, my God. No kidding.
Well, I thought it was really interesting just because being brought up Catholic, and my family is extreme in the church. Almost everyone in my family works for the Catholic Church. And so I know full well that working for the church is such a status symbol. Like, it is knowing the ins and outs, having like a very personal relationship with the priests. It's an extreme status symbol. And so I thought that that was a really great thing that they did, that the people that had like positions with the church were the ones that were the first to like get on board. Everyone who worked for the church was automatically in there, and they held status in the community as well.
That's
why
leaders.
Bev was able to get away with being a fucking monster, because she had so much status within the church, which is all they had.
Fuck her.
I was going to say, exactly. Bev is the prime example of that. Like, no one questioned her at all, and she was a fucking cunt.
Oh my god,
straight up cunt. Like,
people did question her, and she just plowed right over them, because she's one of those people that can just talk them in circles and will bring up any point that she can, that proves the direction she wants to go.
Oh, I think in this chapter, blah, verse, blah, God, mm-hmm. like, no, they fuck your human interpretation, which bastardizes everything.
Right.
Right. Like, fuck that.
I need to be very mindful because not only was that actress fucking amazing at being a right-wing religious Karen, she fucking killed the shit out of it. I want to see her in more stuff, but I need to repeat in my mind, this isn't Bev.
Right.
Because she did such a good job. I don't want to sight unseen where I just treat her like I treat Tom Cruise, where I'm just like, fuck that guy. Like, I know it's a role. I know it's a role, and I have to deprogram myself from hating her with every ounce of my body.
I did want to give her, the actress, a specific name shout out. Her name is Samantha Sloyan. Mm-hmm. She was also in Hush. And one of the random little tidbits that I did learn that I do want to share, because I don't think that it gives anything away, is that her character talks about the book Midnight Mass, which is what our main character is writing in that film, and talks about how she loves the characters of Riley and Aaron in the film Hush prior to the final concepted version of Midnight Mass.
Which is so cool that book or that this story has been featured in several other Flanagan pieces as like a book on a shelf or a story somebody's reading.
Because, it's like an Easter egg.
Yeah, a little bit.
As a means to keep the story alive when he didn't think it would happen.
And I got to say, so far from all that I have seen from Flanagan, which is, I'd say most of his stuff, but not all, this is my favorite that he's done. He's done some very good stuff beforehand, but this touches a certain mark for me, having grown up. Well, I did the tour. I did Catholicism, Lutheran, and Episcopal. So I did the tour, but it does speak very much on how quickly people are able to turn something good about loving one another and into this weird judgmental, hateful kind of mentality.
Did the tour. Coming to a town near you.
Yeah.
Self-hate.
Self-hate. Guilt.
Tour.
The tour.
Guilt tour.
Guilt tour.
2021.
No, but so for me, I learned actually with this to separate his films from his TV series.
Okay.
Because this Haunting of Hill House and this and Bly Manor had so much room to breathe as a story.
Sure.
That it's really hard to compare. I get the connection that you're saying with straight up the Catholicism in this fucking film and the brainwashing and the blind following. No one ever heard of a fucking vampire in this world, apparently. Anyway.
No shit.
Right?
Yeah.
We said that so many times.
The angels are horrifying.
Yeah.
Yes.
True.
Yes. Angels are fucking horrifying too, but they don't suck your blood.
Right.
Anyway.
I've yet to meet an angel, so
I mean, I'm just saying
that's because you are an angel.
Oh, damn it. You got there first. Yeah.
She's better than you. Anyway.
I know.
All right.
I didn't grow up Catholic, but I grew up in the church and I went to a private school, telling me to Virginia. So it's not as hardcore beat over your head as Catholicism, but there is still, you are instilled with certain things. When is that involved in your daily life, right? So Midnight Mass, I feel like it's really hard for me because I really love The Haunting of Hill House, just comparing it to TV shows.
Yeah.
Like his films, like I said, they're like, I can't put that in the same edge because with a film, he gets 2 hours, 2.5 hours max, right?
Yeah.
Like you got 7 hours here. You got 10 hours with Haunting of Hill House.
Yeah.
Well,
I do want to get into the kind of the main focus of the story is taking the vampire mythos and incorporating it into the Catholic Jesus mythos to a degree, like in combining those two together and then seeing how weirdly seamless some of it is. This is my blood, the sacrificing of one's blood to the parishioners. And I mean, it fit uneasily well into each other.
I didn't realize that I was the only one that was raised atheist in this group. So I'm coming at this from a completely outsider's perspective.
That's amazing.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
And it was one of those things that I feel like it fit really well into why a lot of the people in in general will find religion where they're looking for answers.
Sure.
Like, you know, Flanagan asked, like, how do we live and what happens when we die?
Right.
And so those are two things that, like, he's still looking for an answer for. And in a way, you know, when we get something we can't explain and our brain is searching for an answer, then if you have the opportunity to say it's a miracle, mm-hmm. that's a neat little package that your brain doesn't then have to start delving into the horrors of what the reality of this creature existing means.
Yeah,
that was, I think, probably the most fascinating element of this story for me is that, you know, I've watched a lot of different things that revolve around a religion, of course. And I feel like they can get a little ham-handed, or like you're trying really mm-hmm. hard to push like an anti-religious message, which mm-hmm. I understand, but I feel like sometimes they're kind of disingenuous or they don't get that point across. Mm-hmm. This kind of blew my mind because it is science fiction, but I truly found it to be so unbelievably realistic to me. I could see this happening, the miracles of it all. I remember as a child hearing about like people that have stigmata and saying that that's real and that, you know, all the saints have to perform miracles to be a saint. So these kind of things are truly common knowledge, but also the just forgiving monstrous behavior. I mean, when you think about the track record of some of the leadership in the Catholic Church, and I have known some personally that are in prison that are still, like, families still support. Like, these things are crazy realistic.
Yeah.
And it's a huge fucking bummer, but it is true. I thought that this was the most realistic depiction of Catholicism I've ever seen on screen.
Well, when you're trained to believe in something, no matter what the facts provide, that it doesn't matter what actually happens, you still believe in it no matter what. So mm-hmm. People can act monstrously, but they're doing it for God. And you can explain it away because logic is no longer part of the conversation. And that's clearly what happens in this series, where logic is not even really part of the conversation to start with this island for a lot of people. And then you incorporate these miracles and all the outliers are like, well, yep, fuck, yep, we're in. And then nothing can convince them otherwise after that, even when a fucking vampire shows up and it's like, you have to die. And they're like, cool, let's die. Let's drink poison. Let's drink fucking poison. Cool.
One of the things that I did want to say about it, because I feel like Flanagan's beef is more fanaticism than it is religion in general, mm-hmm. because I do, one of the things that I did feel is like he did have a love for some of the things that he grew up with. Like, you can tell that there's something about like the way that it's presented that he wanted to craft very carefully, and it is crafted with love, that the presentation of the hymns, especially with them all singing together as in their final moments, and as a means to ground them in community, that choice of song is really powerful. And he, I think, is fighting parts of his life in that aspect, where he is both aggressively angry about blindness and fanaticism and how quickly things can turn to violence. And yet he still wants to push through to that hope that he wants to be able to find in all things, whether it's religious sure. or otherwise.
So with everything that was just said, the fanaticism, the just this hardcore belief, no matter what the facts are, because you can take those facts and you can fit them into what you believe deep in your heart and your soul of what is the your reality.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to talk about the Monsignor, like that character.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow.
Right. Like, I mean, like he's the character you love to hate kind of thing, because he is so so passionate to the point of, you know, like almost tears talking about this. Like, this is so amazing. This is so great. Mm-hmm. Oh, the light and this and that. And you're like, the portrayal by the actor who I don't have his name right.
Hamish Linklater.
A fucking amazing performance by
Incredible.
Him.
Incredible.
And you see his progression as he gets closer to the ultimate, you know, what happens in the end of episode 6 going into episode 7, like how he has changed. Like, the one doctor's mom was like, that is not my Monsignor. Mm-hmm. Like, that is mm-hmm. not the same man. But it's like, he is so, he, without a doubt, believes 100% he was blessed by an angel. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. They put this fucking disgusting creature in a white robe. Here's an angel. Let me display him to you. You know, and but that that speaks volumes to just the blind obsession and fanaticism of like, no, and to the isolation of like, they are so isolated. Like, no, of course this is, because nobody from the outside world is like, that's not a fucking angel, dumbasses. Like, he's right, making your town dry. Like, you know, there's nobody from the outside world to say, stop, you're fucking idiots. But I wonder if that character was slightly supposed to be Flanagan.
I think so Riley Flynn is the one that he talks about being an awkward or an incomplete avatar of himself.
Okay.
Because when this was first, when this was first penned at a novel in 2010, he was still in the middle of his own battle with alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think potentially realized that it was alcoholism at that point. Because like the first script that he penned was in May 2012, realized that it should be more of a series in 2013. And 2014 was the first time that he did a series imagining. And he's only been sober for 3 years. So he, like, his battle with alcoholism specifically was ongoing through all the way up to this point, where, you know, he, I think, is channeling his, you know, struggles with faith and and addiction through that character and his deepest fears of killing someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I totally see the connection with the alcoholism and his connection with Riley in that aspect. I guess I was more wondering if some of him was in the dialogue and the character of Monsignor, because the Monsignor himself realized he was wrong.
Mm.
You know what I mean? At the end, the turn, he was like, no, this is not right. This was wrong. And he's like remorseful. He wants to repent for all the wrong he did and the evil he brought to this town. So I didn't know if that maybe was part of Flanagan's deal with religion, like finding where you realize, oh no, this is not
I could see that.
The end of the, you know, this is not the right path.
Well, I don't think you're entirely wrong there, but I don't think it's because of his personal, I think the conversation that's happening between Bev and the Monsignor, especially towards the end, is the nature of how you approach the religion. Whereas the Monsignor, clearly, even with trying to help Riley with his addiction, his entire focus the entire time was healing and helping. His whole focus was, and he was completely off base on it, but his intentions were good.
And pure. They were pure.
They were pure. Then when you see that turn where he realizes that it's evil that he's been putting upon this town, he has a total shift where he goes, oh, fuck, no. Yeah, burn it all down. Burn it the fuck down. Yeah. This is terrible. Whereas Bev, her focus with the church was always power.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It was control, was being in charge of people. It had nothing to do with faith.
She was always evil.
She was always evil. She was always looking to be in control of people. So when it broke down and was pretty clearly evil, she was like, fuck it, I'm in charge, so this is cool, and was more than happy to take the reins from the Monsignor. Mm-hmm. So that, I think it relates to his probably dealing with AA or religion, with his challenges with alcoholism, seeing the difference between people wanting to find peace and people wanting to find power.
Think we get some of that reckoning with Annie Flynn, with Annie's confrontation with her, where she starts with, Bev, you are not a good person. And it's
good.
One of my favorite moments in the series, because holy shit, are there so many people that need that speech.
No shit.
And okay, first of all, I want to apologize if I was a downer. I know that there are good Catholics out there, and Annie is one of them, you know, you can get wrapped up in it. But I do think that the fanaticism thing, especially with Bev, is so fascinating and perfectly like on note, because my favorite moment of the whole series that I just thought was perfect was the very end when, you know, the sun is coming out, everyone knows that they're about to die, and Bev, who has been the whole time preaching about, you know, the afterlife and thinking that she is the greatest person of all, tries to hide from death, which that's what you should be going for, is that's your ultimate salvation.
That's set up earlier in the thing where
the dialogue,
in the dialogue where they're like, this is like paradise and all this stuff. And people try to, I think she even says it about somebody else. People try to fight to survive even when paradise is awaiting them.
Right.
And it's such a weird idea. So and that's good. Exactly what she does at the end of it. It's chef's kiss.
But Can we talk about the Flynns? They are adorable. An adorable couple.
Oh, yeah.
Like, as soon as his backstop hurt, and he's like, all I want to do is dance with my wife. You know what I mean? Like, everything leading up. And then they both come back as vampires, and they're like, no, I didn't do it. I didn't do it, Bev. Like, so it's just sweet. Such good. Yeah. So good, man. So, yeah. Henry Thomas, right? Correct?
Yep. Henry Thomas. Yeah. Ed Flynn.
He crushes it. And that actress is new to me, but she is just amazing. It's just this, yes, very, you know, very devout. Strong in her faith. Very devout. Yes, thank you. Very devout. And also a mother, and then also realizing, like, okay, no, this is wrong. And they stick together about that and don't dive into what the town does. That was beautiful because you see the relationship through the whole series, and I love that. I love that.
And the thing I want to kind of finish on is right with one of the last scenes of the show before we finish up here is that the young lady who gets healed from being paralyzed, that as they're escaping on the boat and she's been, you know, did not take the sacrament and she's not a vampire. She's like, I can't feel my legs. And just the weird contrast of coming back to being a disabled person being almost a relief of it being almost an ascension away from the evil that you were possibly going to be a part of. That relief of being like, I don't feel my legs. Cool. You know, like this like relief that comes up. It was such a weird and really interesting contrast to just how people would normally deal with that situation. You know, I thought it was a beautiful little note that there are far worse things than not having use of your legs.
Like that's true.
Eating your friends is one of them.
Or your dad. Or your kids.
Anyway. Yeah.
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 I do want to say that they're like one of the moments that just like utterly made me weep towards that ending was, you know, the whole town that has accepted what's going to happen has gathered together to sing.
Yep.
With the exception of like a few of the couples who have paired off to do, you know, their own things. Fuck you, Bev. But they're all singing together. And as the sun comes up, they're getting to that climax of the song and it just goes silent.
Yeah.
And there's
beautiful.
Nothing.
So well fucking perfect. Done. That was so good because you get that bird's eye view of the whole island and it's just silence. Yeah. Like
it's silence and fire. Oh my God.
But on that note, let's conclude this. Thank you so much for listening to this little mini-sode from Geeks Under the Influence. Check us out on GUIpodcast.com. All the other shows available. We're going to be back next week with a new full-length episode. So we'll find you next time. Thank you so much to the panel for talking about this amazing show. And as always, join us or die.
Shut the fuck up, Hobbit.
GUIpodcast.com.
My name is Amy Bogard.
And I'm Mike the Hobbit.
And we are the hosts of Deeply Upsetting, where we use our expertise to answer your most upsetting hypothetical quandaries, such as what non-Wiggan animal deserves wings?
And what body part deserves a secret mouth?
Which cryptid is the worst roommate?
These questions and more that plague you will be answered on Deeply Upsetting, available anywhere you get your podcasts and at GUIpodcast.com.
In a world ravaged by movie studios that keep rehashing the same things, only one podcaster has the guts to make it even worse. Join Mike the Hobbit as he traverses the internet to bring you some of the best and worst ideas for reboots, remakes, and reimaginings of some of your favorite and least favorite TV and film properties. Ideas like a John Waters He-Man movie, Fantastic Four the musical, and Aliens done entirely with marionettes. What podcast would bring this evil upon the world? This is Smack My Pitch Up. Available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Coming straight from the mouths of madness, I'm Lowdown.
I'm F.U. Hunter.
Do you love horror?
We fucking do.
So this is a podcast dedicated to all things in cinematic horror. We're talking movies, television, composers, special effects artists. We're going to fucking cover it.
So if you love horror,
embrace the madness.